From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, Dr. Mona Hanna Attisha on her memoir about the Flint water crisis, What the Eyes Don't See.
When I think of this crisis, I think of it as a series of dominoes, and I am like the last domino. Like, it should have stopped when that first mom said, hey, there's something wrong with my water.
Remembering the first moment she heard Flint's water may have lead in it.
I'm like, are you kidding me? Like, how can water not be treated properly, and how can that result in lead in the water?
We talk with the immigration lawyer representing children separated from their parents at the southern border and sent to Michigan.
It says that our government has perpetrated a massive human rights violation.
Plus, growing hemp in Michigan, the legal challenges and possible rewards. Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Hello, and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Pediatrician Dr. Mona Hanna Attisha helped expose the Flint water crisis. Now, she's sharing her story in her new memoir.
When I think of this crisis, I think of it as a series of dominoes, and I am like the last domino. Like, it should have stopped when that first mom said, hey, there's something wrong with my water.
That conversation later in the hour, but first, President Trump's executive order ending family separations but not the zero tolerance policy at the southern border did nothing to quell national anger and confusion. His order did not address just what happens for some 2,300 children taken from their parents after crossing the border. Some of those children are in foster care here in Michigan. Let's talk about where they are and what the future might hold for them as we welcome Susan Reed, managing attorney with the Michigan Immigrant Rights Center. It's a legal resource center for immigrant communities in our state. Susan, welcome back.
Thank you, Cindy.
Before we talk about the numbers of migrant children in Michigan, we should be clear here that young migrants have been coming here and being put in foster care in Michigan as unaccompanied minors. And just to be clear, that meant what in terms of circumstance and numbers?
Sure. Well, Michigan does have two federal foster care programs for unaccompanied children. They are two of the largest programs in the country, and they're run by Samaritas, formerly Lutheran Social Services of Michigan, and Bethany Christian Services. They have both temporary and long-term programs at Bethany and long-term programs at Samaritas. What that means is that, well, I've been representing children in those programs for about 15 years. What it has meant historically is these are children who've come to the U.S. alone or, you know, been encountered alone in the U.S. by law enforcement and who need care and custody from a public entity. And so Bethany and Samaritas have subcontracts with the U.S. Office of Refugee Resettlement to do that care and custody for unaccompanied children. What changed is that the government began separating children who did not arrive in the U.S. unaccompanied, taking them from their families and putting them in the government's existing custody system for unaccompanied children. And so now we have unaccompanied children and separated children kind of mixed together in those programs, which is really problematic because they have different needs and different realities.
And different goals, right?
Absolutely. You know, reunification is not really the goal of most unaccompanied children. Freedom and safety in the U.S. through asylum or special immigrant juvenile status or another permanent immigration status is the goal of unaccompanied children. And the government may be seeking to reunify children by deporting them back to family violence or gang violence or another bad circumstance that they fled or that their family sent them away from. Separated children, we would say, absolutely need to be reunified, but their entire family also needs the chance to pursue safety and freedom in the U.S. and be released from detention while that's happening. That's really a nuance. Even the government is now saying they want to reunify separated children with their families, but they're saying they want to detain those families. The executive order essentially says that families would be indefinitely detained while they sought asylum, parents and children together, and that's a problem. In other cases, the government may be saying parents and children should be reunified, but they mean reunified and deported, reunified abroad. And so there's just a lot of nuance because some parents may tell us when we contact them that they don't believe their child will survive if they take their child back to the home country. And so the parent may, if they're forced to, choose to be deported alone.
How many children would you say have come to Michigan since the zero tolerance policy began in April, children who were separated?
We do represent every child in the foster care programs, and we interact with every child. And so the numbers you've seen from other sources are correct. I would say about 50 of the children we've seen have been separated. The official numbers don't distinguish between unaccompanied and separated children, but that's roughly about what we've seen.
And as you talk about these separated children, Susan Reed, what's the youngest age you've seen?
3 months old.
3 months old.
Three months old, Cindy.
What does that say to you?
It says that our government has perpetrated a massive human rights violation. You know, the folks who've worked with unaccompanied children are scrambling to figure out what the ethical and moral thing to do next is and what everyone's role should be. We are really grateful for the community support that we've received at Merck for our program. We have 4 lawyers and 2 paralegals who are fighting for justice for these kids every day.
Susan, we're seeing reports, hearing reports, that some very young children are arriving in Michigan with essentially no information, that in some cases, not even the name of a parent. Can you confirm that? Have you seen and heard that?
That has not been our experience, that we have no information about our clients, but typically what we know is the parent's name and the detention facility where they're held. We have to talk to parents to be able to represent kids. The kids can't tell us their story. They can't tell us their family's experience and situation. We have to talk to the detained parent who they came with. Talking to family and friends abroad is absolutely no substitute for that. The parent and child could be fleeing family violence abroad. And so typically what we do know for younger children is the parent's name and location, but that's really where the communication stops. Our staff are pounding the phone lines to try to talk to these parents in detention, but for those of your listeners who've ever tried to make a phone call to someone who's held in a jail, the world is not set up that way. And we've really received very limited, if any, cooperation from the government on getting parents on the phone with us to begin to understand the family's situation. So we're leaving messages with Customs and Border Protection officers and contract facility staff saying we absolutely have to talk to this person. It's taking weeks to get a hold of detained parents.
Now, these children, are they all in homes? Are they in a family setting, or is that what Samaritas and Bethany provides for them?
Yeah, Michigan's programs only have foster care and then some small group homes for older children. Michigan does not have any of the large shelter facilities like you've seen in the footage at the border.
And there are people wondering, why were these children sent to Michigan and other states instead of keeping them there near where their parents are? What do you say to that?
Well, yeah. I mean, again, they were sent to Michigan because they were classified as unaccompanied minors after being taken from their parents and their parents referred for prosecution for unlawful entry or for attempted unlawful entry or in other cases simply civilly detained. I'm not sure if people realize this, but most asylum seekers now are detained when they present at a port of entry. Throughout the last several weeks, the administration made several statements that people who presented at a port of entry would not have their children separated from them. They would go into family detention. That is not true. We saw children who did come to a port of entry and were taken from their parents at a port of entry. And we've seen a lot of credible reporting about people being arrested as they approached ports of entry for attempted unlawful entry, even where it was clear that they were attempting to reach a port of entry to apply for asylum. So the reason separated children were sent to Michigan is because once they were classified as unaccompanied, they went into the regular unaccompanied system, and foster care is a priority for younger children as a better form of immigration detention than being in a large shelter.
There are people listening to you right now who want to help these children who have come to Michigan. What are the best ways to help, and what is perhaps not so helpful?
Well, I do really want to invite people to take a look at legislation that would restrict the administration's practices. I should be clear that legislation is not required. The government could stop this practice at any time. I should also be clear that I don't believe the executive order is likely to bring an end to family detention, because the executive order does not end the zero tolerance policy, and it simply directs the government to try to get the Flores settlement, which limits detention of children in family detention to 3 weeks. The president's executive order last week directed the government to try to get that changed, but I don't see why a federal judge would change that order simply because the government wants out of that responsibility and for no other reason. So while the executive order envisions massive family detention and indefinite family detention, if they don't get the Flores settlement 3-week limit on the detention of children in detention facilities changed, then they will either continue separating families or they will be in violation of the Flores settlement by indefinitely detaining children there. So while legislation is not necessarily needed to end these horrible practices, the will to completely end them does not appear to be there at the executive level, and so we want to urge people to urge members of Congress to support the Keep Families Together Act, Senate 3036. People need to understand that these children are still detained, that they're still in Michigan. There were some misleading statements from the government that there are no more separated children in Border Patrol custody, but that is because they get transferred to the U.S. Office of Refugee Resettlement custody after 72 hours, and thousands of children are still in their custody, so running down misinformation about that, and understanding that there is really no plan for reunification, and the plan that exists in the executive order is not viable legally.
Susan Reed, managing attorney for the Michigan Immigrant Rights Center. Thank you so much, Susan.
Thank you, Cindy.
Still to come, we'll talk with the pediatrician who exposed the Flint water crisis about her new memoir, and then the prospect and potential of industrial hemp right here in Michigan. That story is in 20 minutes. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The world knows her as the Flint pediatrician in the white coat, the doctor who used science to force the state of Michigan to admit it had caused the Flint water crisis, one of the worst public health disasters in our nation's history. People stop to salute her as a hero, and she'll tell you, no, she was just doing her job. Now Dr. Mona Hanna-Attisha brings us the story of crisis, resistance, and hope in Flint, all in her new book, What the Eyes Don't See.
This is the story of the most important and emblematic environmental and public health disaster of this young century. More bluntly, it is a story of a government poisoning its own citizens and then lying about it. It is a story about what happens when the very people responsible for keeping us safe care more about money and power than they care about us or our children. But there is another story, another side of Flint, because it is also a story about how we came together and fought back, and how each of us, no matter who we are, a parent, an activist, a school teacher, a pediatrician, has within us a piece of the answer. We each have the power to fix things. We can open one another's eyes to problems.
An excerpt from the opening pages of What the Eyes Don't See, and it is a pleasure to say, Dr. Mona Hanna-Attisha, welcome back to Stateside.
Cynthia, it's always great to be with you.
Pleasure to have you here. What told you, Dr. Mona, that the time was right for this moment to bring us your take on the story of what happened in Flint.
Yeah, so I started working on this book over 2 years ago, and I knew even back then that we would need a vehicle to shine a spotlight back on Flint. The nation's attention with Fade that go on to other stories, understandably, but our story in Flint is a long-term story, and I wanted people to recognize that our crisis is ongoing and our recovery is also long-term.
What really struck me is, as I read your book, so many things, so many people in your life clicked into place to make you the right person in the right place at the right time to speak truth to power and to intervene. And it probably didn't feel like that at the time, did it?
Yeah, absolutely. One of the reasons I didn't want to write this book, because this story is absolutely not about me. This is a story about a team of folks who came together and a team of folks who are as diverse as you can imagine, journalists and moms and activists and pastors and water scientists and my family and my network and my high school friends, all these random folks who came together to uncover this crisis. And I think that's one of the most important lessons of this crisis and of folks who are, you know, struggling on other issues, is that you have a team of folks around you. You can build a village and you're never alone in whatever you're addressing.
I'm interested, as I read the book, in the personal history, the part of you that we all didn't see as you were standing at the press conference and showing your research and what went into that and what brought you to that moment. Your personal history, your family emigrated from Saddam Hussein's Iraq. You were actually born in England,
mm-hmm.
and you were, what, four when your family came to Michigan?
Yep, we came actually to the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, to Michigan Tech.
And what brought your family to Michigan?
Sure. So I was born in the UK. I was born in Sheffield, England. My father was studying there. He was getting his PhD in metallurgical engineering. So I've always lived with the periodic table and with metals. And the plan was when he was done with his PhD, we would go back home to Iraq. And that's when Saddam Hussein was rising in power, and that's when his brutality and his dictatorship and his really reign of terror was becoming evident. And my parents knew that they could not go back there. So we emigrated to the States. We came to Michigan, and of all places, we came to the Upper Peninsula, literally 12 hours away from Metro Detroit. And my father began a postdoc, continuing his research there. Then he got a job with General Motors as an engineer at the tech center in Warren, and we stayed in Royal Oak for the next few decades.
Now, in your book, you write, and here's your quote, "We paid a price for our new American lives in ways that were often unexpected and painful." How so?
Yeah, so in Royal Oak at that time, we were one of only few brown kids in a majority white, you know, suburban neighborhood. And these kind of insults, and they were mild insults, things like, oh, camel jockeys or go back home, would often occur when the U.S. was at war either with Iraq or another country from the Middle East. It didn't faze us very much. Obviously, it hurt when it happened, but we didn't kind of let it sink in.
How do you think that prepared you, though, for the role you wound up embracing in Flint?
Yeah. So, you know, I always, as an immigrant coming to this country, I was really, by and large, welcomed with open arms. And because of that, I grew up confident and I grew up competent. And, you know, I always had this kind of self-esteem that told me that I could do anything I wanted to do. I worry about what's happening right now in the nation with a population of brown kids who may not be experiencing the same thing. But because of that perspective, I valued the differences that I brought to the table.
You tell us in your book that you wanted to be a doctor for about as long as you remember, but it seems to trace very much to something terrifying that happened to your family. You were only five. Tell us about that winter night driving home to Houghton.
Yeah, so we were making that long drive from Metro Detroit to Houghton, Michigan, once again, 12 hours. And we were around the Gaylord area, so north of Flint, on I-75. And my brother and I were in the back seats. Nobody at that time was wearing seatbelts because you just didn't really wear seatbelts then. And the car hit a patch of black ice. And I was very thin as a child, and I was essentially weightless. And the car swerved back and forth, hitting the guardrails on both sides multiple times. And each time it hit a guardrail, I was thrust to one side of the car and then to the other side of the car.
Like a little rag doll.
Like a little rag doll. And finally, the guardrails ran out, and the car plunged into a ditch. I broke my neck. I fractured my jaw. We were taken to a hospital in Traverse City,
where I stayed for quite a bit of time with undergoing multiple operations. My teeth were actually braced together. I couldn't eat anything that wasn't through a straw. So my mom would make all our kind of homemade Arabic food in a blender. So like rice and stews and dolma, grape leaves, all these things she would blend for me and I would eat them through a straw. But what I remember from that time is the care that I got. And I remember very vividly a young doctor who came to our side, and my mom was worried. She spoke limited English, no medical knowledge. My mom noticed that my face was crooked. And this young doctor was dark-skinned. She had dark hair. She had a white coat on. And she held my hand, and she said, "You were in a terrible accident. You are going to be okay." And then flash forward 30 years from then, I am that doctor, and I am looking over another, you know, set of children who have gone through a very similar accident that wasn't their fault, and now I am telling them that they are going to be okay.
It's clear you were born to be a pediatrician, but you also, amazingly, as I read the book, said, look at this, you actually crafted your own pre-med track at U of M because you wanted to study environmental health. So how did that interest happen?
Yeah, so I actually started back in high school. So I grew up in Royal Oak, Kimball High School, and we had a really active environmental club. And we did things that high school environmental clubs do. So we recycled and we put on like environmental plays for the elementary school, and I always played Mother Earth. But then we started getting involved in a local community group. Madison Heights was an adjacent city to us, and they had a trash burning incinerator that was literally adjacent to an elementary school and a senior center. And that incinerator had been operating for years. And when people in that neighborhood woke up, there was a layer of soot around their house and on their driveway on top of their cars. And that local environmental group, Clean Air Please, led by this amazing, strong, courageous nurse, had done a study and found that kids had higher rates of asthma in that neighborhood. Adults had higher rates of COPD, respiratory problems. So we took to the streets. We became activists. So at the kind of ripe old age of 13, 14, I couldn't drive. My parents dropped me off at these protests. We became part of a real fight. And then ultimately, we elected one of our fellow activists to the state legislature, John Freeman, who enacted a law that an incinerator could never open that close to a school. And that incinerator shut down in my sophomore year of high school.
So you saw the results of activism at a very young age.
At a super young age. And not only activism, but the role that environment can play on health and the critical role of policy and policymakers.
So here you go through medical school, you're in Flint at Hurley, you're seeing beautiful little children, and you're providing the best pediatric care you know how. Take us back to August 26, 2015, that family barbecue you had with your longtime friend, Elin.
Yeah, so Elin Warren, now Batanzo, is a longtime high school girlfriend. We were part of those same environmental fights in high school, and we'd kept connected throughout college and throughout our careers. And it was a last-minute barbecue. So I just texted her earlier the day. I'm like, hey, another one of our high school friends is in town. Can you come over? And we all had little kids. She's like, yeah, I can make it. I'm free. I can come over. So she comes over, and our kids were all playing. We were all catching up. And she asks me, she's like, Mona, you know, you work in Flint? I'm like, yeah, obviously. She's like, well, you know, what have you heard about the water? I'm like, it's okay. Of course it's okay. I just took care of a kid, you know, yesterday in clinic. Mom was worried about the water. She was going to stop breastfeeding. They were going to move to formula. She asked if the water was okay. And I reassured her. I've been telling everybody that the water is okay.
Because it's well over a year since the switch had been made in April of 2014.
Absolutely. Yeah. It was about 17 months into the water switch. And as a pediatrician, I kept telling everybody it was okay because that's what I was being told. That's what everybody was being told, that it was okay. And she turns to me and she's like, you know, it's not okay. She had just seen a memo from a former colleague of hers at the EPA. She worked at the EPA in Washington, D.C. when they had a very similar lead and water crisis over a decade ago. And she's like, I know this guy. He's competent. He wouldn't write this memo if he wasn't concerned. It sounds like Flint's not treating its water properly. And because of that, there's probably going to be lead in the water. And that was the very first time I heard the word lead. You know, I'd heard about the bacteria and the color and the odor and, you know, rashes and something called total trihalomethanes, which you can't even say, you know, a byproduct of chlorine disinfection. So I heard about all these things. But who doesn't expect that when you turn on your water, it's not safe. I mean, this is America, the richest country in the history of the world. It is Michigan, literally in the middle of the largest source of fresh water in the world. But despite that, there's laws and the regulations, and there's people whose job, their main job, is to make sure that our water is safe. There's a lot of history in my book, but I talk about a time when our water wasn't safe, at the time of kind of raging cholera epidemics in London. So we've come a long way. Treatment of water has saved millions of lives. It's really the foundation of civilizations. And so I just, when she told me that it wasn't being treated okay, it was a disbelief. I'm like, are you kidding me? Like, how can water not be treated properly? And how can that result in lead in water? Before that moment, like, I didn't even know there was lead in our plumbing. I mean, that's how naive I was.
And in 28 days, when you stop and realize what you did to figure out and prove what had happened to the blood lead levels in the children you saw, and that it had spiked after the water switch, you had the science. That's an astonishing fast rate to pull science together. And it really took a toll on you.
But it was with a team. I was never alone. Yes. I had folks who mm-hmm. were at my side, who were helping me, especially.
Including coaching from Elon.
Absolutely.
Who was helping you along.
Absolutely. Elon was helping me along. Elon gave me kind of this crash graduate course on water treatment, but also my research colleagues who were helping me do this work. And then, yeah, what we found was that the blood lead levels of children, you know, increased, but it was also a gross underestimation of exposure because that blood work was done on the screening lead levels of children, which is done at an age when we worry about household lead exposure, paint and dust. That's when kids are crawling and walking and have that hand-to-mouth activity. Whereas we knew that this lead and water exposure affected a younger age group and kids weren't being screened at that time.
And as you were pulling this together, you were making phone calls to Lansing, to the county, to anybody, and basically you got crickets.
Yeah.
You got nothing.
No response.
And then came the day of the press conference that kind of introduced you to the world. What do you remember about how you felt going into that?
I wanted to get this off my shoulders because we had the evidence, we had the science, we had the facts that the blood lead levels of children, you know, had increased after the water switch. I'm not a patient person. Like, I'm an action person. I wanted to get this out as soon as possible because I wanted people to take precautions. So I was relieved. I was ready for that press conference. I wanted to shout these results like from a mountaintop. I wanted to get them out because without that, people would have continued to drink this water. So I also knew that what I was doing was an academic no-no, which is why I won this award from MIT, a disobedience award, which was difficult to tell my children that I just got a disobedience award, but it was a form of academic disobedience. So academics, pediatricians, doctors, you do not share research before it has gone through the peer review process, before publication. And that takes months. Doing that work would take months.
And you knew you didn't have months.
My children did not have a day. This needed to come out as soon as possible.
And you were seeing children as you were doing this. What was that like being in clinic, not yet having the actual proof, but really having that terrible feeling something was wrong? How did you deal with that with your patients and
families?
Yeah,
so, you know, there's a concept in public health called the precautionary principle, like err on the side of precaution. If you have a concern, it's better to prevent any kind of injury or exposure. So once I had heard about that lead in the water, I started telling my patients that they should take precautions. So I was seeing kids. So I was seeing kids with, after I realized, I was seeing kids with rashes. I was seeing kids who may have had gotten conditions that were associated with this water. So I started telling them, you know, avoid this water. And they would just like stare at me like, why should I avoid this water? Everybody says it's okay. And even my colleagues are like, but, you know, everybody says it's okay. Why should we recommend, you know, bottled water for a baby who's using formula rather than tap water?
And then after that press conference, all those state officials who would not return your calls, suddenly they pounced on you. And I remember this very, very well, that MDEQ spokesman Brad Werfel called your conclusions unfortunate. The Department of Health and Human Services tried to discredit your science. Governor Snyder's office claimed your data had been diced and spliced, and which is what the ultimate insult to a scientist, isn't it? What was that like for you as you saw yourself portrayed as an unfortunate local pediatrician researcher?
You know, writing this book, when you write the story, those emotions all come back. And there was a knot in my stomach that wouldn't go away. I wanted to throw up. My heart rate, I had just gotten a Fitbit, so I knew what my heart rate was. It was close to 200.
you know, when the entire state tells you you're wrong, it's hard not to believe it. I began to believe them, and I was scared, and I literally was under the covers. I'm like, what have I done? I've gone out of my field. I should have stayed seeing my patients. You know, it was anxiety and fear, and it became physical. So I literally stopped eating, and my hands were trembling.
What broke that?
So what broke that was that night, I remember my daughter also had a curriculum night at school. So I had gone from that press conference right to my daughter's school. And I was being inundated then with the media. And like, you know, what do you think? The state says you're wrong. You know, what's your response? And I left my daughter's curriculum night. I left my husband there. He had to walk home. And I went home and I shut off. And then around like 3 a.m., I woke up. And I woke up with this newfound strength. And I realized that my science, my facts, my evidence, my research was about numbers. But that every single number in my research was a kid, was a child, was one of my Flint kids, and probably a kid that I had taken care of and seen in that last year. And these are kids that are already struggling with really every adversity you can imagine. And it is those kids, and it was their names, and it was their faces that woke me up and that put me back in this ring and got me to fight back for them. Because I wasn't just fighting for their todays. I was literally fighting for their futures.
We'll continue my conversation with Dr. Mona Hanna-Hattisha. How would she grade the state's response to the Flint water disaster? And who was that man in the panda tie who also used science to fight for Flint? That's still ahead, right here on Stateside. Welcome back to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty, continuing my conversation with Dr. Mona Hanna-Hattisha. She talks about her new memoir, What the Eyes Don't See. In the book, she writes about the team effort it took to force the state to admit that its cost-cutting water switch to the Flint River had caused one of the greatest environmental disasters in U.S. history. She credits citizen activists like Leanne Walters, the EPA's lead in water specialist Miguel del Toro, and a tenacious water scientist from Virginia. This seems like the time to talk about some other members of the team that were so important, starting with the man in the panda tie. Dr. Mark Edwards from Virginia Tech. And the first picture you saw of him, that tie jumped out because it had a giant panda. What did that tell you about him?
It told me he was brave to wear such a tie. You know, Elin, a water expert, also who had trained at Virginia Tech, warned me about him. She's like, everybody in the water world knows about Mark Edwards. Like, he's got this reputation. He would do whatever needs to be done to find the truth. And she's like, you know, he's explosive. You know, he's, you know, radioactive. She used all these different words about him. And I'm like, he's a water engineer. Like, my dad is an engineer. Like, I know engineers.
I get
like,
engineers.
Yeah. I mean, like, I'm like, you know, he's trying to help us here.
Because we've got to remind everybody, he'd been called in by folks like Leanne Walters frustrated Flint residents who weren't being listened to. So he'd been in Flint.
He'd been in Flint.
Water.
He'd been in the story. When he heard from Leanne Walters and others, amazing, amazing Flint residents, that they weren't being taken seriously and that there was lead in the water, he literally packed his minivan with graduate students and supplies and drove up to Flint from the middle of nowhere, Blacksburg, Virginia, to find out what was going on with the water. So he teamed up with the residents of Flint using something called citizen science. And in a very scientific way, they tested the water all over the city of Flint and were sending out alarm bells saying, hey, there is lead in the water. And that's where this crisis should have ended. You know, it should never have gotten to the point of me. So when I think of this crisis, I think of it as a series of dominoes. And I am like the last domino. Like, it should have stopped when that first mom said, hey, there's something wrong with my water.
All the people showing up, showing the
brown jugs of water at like town hall meetings. It should have stopped then. The people should have been taken seriously. It should have have stopped when the investigative journalists were, you know, exposing what was happening. It should have stopped when Mark Edwards showed the science of lead in water, especially with lead, because in public health, what you're supposed to do with lead is something called primary prevention, which means you're never supposed to expose a population to lead because there is no treatment. So you should detect it in the environment before you detect it in a child.
Well, we all know how it played out, that the state had to stand up and admit we blew it. We got it wrong. There was actually a public apology from Governor Snyder. Let's go back to that moment at his State of the State speech in January 2016.
Government failed you, federal, state, and local leaders, by breaking the trust you placed in us. I'm sorry, most of all, that I let you down. You deserve better. You deserve accountability. You deserve to know that the buck stops here with me.
How did that apology strike you?
So we heard a lot of apologies in Flint, and that's great because this could have gone on a lot longer. I never expected any of those apologies. The only comparison that we had to this crisis was what happened in Washington, D.C. about a decade ago. And that took years and years and years and lots of cover-up, and nobody was held accountable, and there were no apologies. So I was surprised at the apologies. I was grateful. But I wanted those apologies to come with action.
So how would you grade the state and federal action since then?
I would say it's about maybe a B. You know, we are replacing our lead pipes. It's not done yet, but we've replaced about 6,000 lead pipes. There's about 9,000 to go. We will only be the third city in the country that's replaced their lead pipes. So that's huge. That's massive. That's partly because of state and federal dollars. We are doing incredible things for the children. And this is where my work is. And this is how I get to spend my every day, is making sure that the children do not see these consequences.
And this is a chance to kind of talk about the work you are doing now for Flint children, now that you've gotten the world's attention and gotten funding. Wraparound services and the Flint Registry. Tell us about those.
Yeah. So the same speed we had in doing this research and figuring out what was happening to our children is and has been and continues to be the same speed that we are working to put in place the interventions to not see the consequences of this crisis. We cannot take away what happened. There's no magic
pill. Can't undo the damage.
No, there's no magic pill. There's no antidote. And we talk about lead, but this is more than a lead crisis. We had a Legionnaires outbreak. We had skin issues. But mostly it's a crisis of loss of trust, betrayal and anger and guilt and stress. Those are the things that we see every day. And just having those emotions and feelings can also cause significant health issues. So the treatment to this crisis, because we cannot take away and because it's ongoing, is really to support the families using science. Flint is a story where science was dismissed, really kind of common sense science. Flint is a story where ultimately science spoke truth to power. And we are now leaning on the incredible science of child development and toxic stress and resilience to mitigate the impact of this crisis. So the wraparound services that we're building are phenomenal, and they're one of a kind. And Flint is doing things that no other city is doing that we know of. We have two brand new child care centers in Flint that care for about 500 children free all year, the highest quality child care centers for the children that were exposed to this crisis. This is amazing. I mean, early child care literally is the most important time of brain development. We have an expansion of home visiting programs. We have parenting support programs, huge investment in early literacy. By the time our kids reach the age of 3, they have heard 30 million less words. You can see evidence of that achievement gap at 18 months of age. So we are doing massive investment in early literacy. Books are literally brain food. Every kid now in Flint gets a book mailed to them from the age of 0 to 5. We have a program called Reach Out and Read, which is an evidence-based, clinic-based literacy program. We are giving babies at birth in the hospital a bundle of books and developmental tools. We have universal early intervention in Flint, home-based developmental support, expansion of nutrition services and WIC programming, a Medicaid waiver to give people the health care and behavioral health access. And I can go on and on. But, you know, these are things all kids need, not just Flint kids. These are literally things that all children need, especially children who are suffering from adversities like poverty and violence and lack of nutrition.
As you watch the proceedings, the criminal proceedings unfold against Nick Lyons and Dr. Eden Wells and so many others who were in power at the time, what are your thoughts?
So I talk quite a bit about this in the book, and I think the accountability is critically important. So I think of the recovery from this crisis as almost a truth and reconciliation process. We need to know the truth. There needs to be that accountability to help with restorative justice and to help with that long path to recovery. So I look forward to the investigations. I look forward to that accountability. And I hope it really awakens folks all over this country about kind of their duty to protect our water, protect our health.
The book is What the Eyes Don't See, taken, I believe, from D.H. Lawrence.
Yes. So the first time I heard that phrase was from one of my pediatricians, one of my professors at Children's Hospital of Michigan in Detroit, Dr. Sarniak. And he used to always grill us when we were seeing patients about different diagnoses and pathophysiologies. And he would say, your eyes don't see what your mind doesn't know, very much telling us, hey, if you haven't read up on something, you're not going to be able to diagnose something. So I think that's where that phrase comes from. And it's about the people and the problems and the places that we choose not to see. It's also very literally about lead in water. We don't see it. We also don't see the consequences of lead for quite some time. But it's also about the power for all of us to open our eyes and to see these things.
Dr. Mona Hanna-Attisha will be at an author talk and book signing this Wednesday, June 27th, an evening of celebration and fundraising for Flint at Stagecrafters in Royal Oak, and it will help benefit the Flint Kids Fund. You can get all the details by going to the stateside page at michiganradio.org. Dr. Mona, a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. On Monday, the Food and Drug Administration made some history. For the very first time, the agency approved a hemp-derived product for using in treating epilepsy. This decision comes as more and more Michigan farmers and researchers have cast their eye on producing hemp for commercial and medical uses. Hemp comes from the same plant as marijuana, but industrial hemp won't get you high. Yet, it's regulated as a Schedule I drug. And unlike researchers in some other states, Michigan scientists have not been able to study the crop. And that means Michigan farmers are losing ground to growers in Canada and other states. Kurt Thielen is a professor in the Department of Plant, Soil, and Microbial Sciences at Michigan State University, and he's with us now. Kurt, tell us just what is industrial hemp and what's it used for?
Industrial hemp, as you mentioned in your introduction, is a plant similar to marijuana, but it does not have the high concentrations of THC, which is the active component in marijuana that gets you high. What hemp is used for, it's kind of a multi-use plant. It's currently used for fiber as a vegetable oil source in the feed oils, as well it has some pharmaceutical properties too, and a component called CBDs that has some activity against childhood seizures. So it does have multiple uses. And then another use would be the grain itself. The seed itself can be used as a grain source. So it has quite a number of different uses, a real multi-purpose type plant.
Does it look like a marijuana plant?
It looks exactly like a marijuana plant. You really can't tell the difference unless you get in and analyze the THC levels in the plant.
And yet, I know you told our producer that if you try to smoke industrial hemp, you might as well grind up the chair you're sitting on and smoke that. It will have no effect on you, yet it's still classified as a Schedule I drug.
That is correct.
And what does that mean for farmers who want to grow it, or researchers like yourself who want to study it?
Because it's regulated, as you mentioned, it's under Schedule I, it falls under that for regulation, which means really you're not supposed to be growing it. Some states have passed laws, and there's been recent changes in the previous farm bill to this one 4 years ago that kind of allow for research to be done to investigate the plant further, you know, for potential adaption at some point on farms. However, as long as it's a Schedule I, falls under that regulation, you still can't move the plant across state lines because of that federal determination.
So no seeds can be transported across state lines, which kind of ties your hands for research or anything else.
That is correct. And that's the reason that at Michigan State University we've been trying to get a permit under Schedule 1 to do the research on it. But we haven't been successful so far. We're trapped somewhere in their paperwork, I guess.
What kind of research do you want to do on industrial hemp, Kurt?
Well, what we're looking to do is just really establish some of what the basic agronomy is going to be for the plant. So when we get to that point, everyone thinks we're going to eventually get to the point where the industrial hemp is legalized. We want to have growers in Michigan positioned so they'll have the information available to know, the basic agronomy of the plant, like what should the row width be? What should the plants per acre be? What should the fertilizer applications be? All those things that we call kind of the basic agronomy, what growers need to know as far as how to grow the plant.
How do you think hemp would do in Michigan? I mean, we grow a lot of corn. We grow a lot of soy in this state. Would hemp like that?
Yes, hemp, it's been characterized as a plant that will grow pretty much anywhere you can grow corn. It likes more fertile soils. We know that much. It likes what we call the finer things in agronomy. It'd be a plant that would adapt well wherever corn can grow.
And what do you think, if these challenges were removed and Michigan growers could kind of get in and begin to grow industrial hemp, what kind of economic potential might it bring to the state?
Well, I'm probably a little more guarded as far as what my expectations would be. It's certainly a plant that's going to have some niche markets for it. But when we look at it in terms of what other plants we have out there, available, like for fiber, for instance. It's a good fiber plant, but we also have cotton and we have, other plants that are probably even a little bit better. But it will have some niche markets. And then when we look at for an oil seed, another example, we have oil seeds that yield a little bit better also. But it is kind of, as I mentioned, a multi-purpose plant, and it's also going to have some high-value niche markets, particularly with regard to some of those pharmaceutical components that I mentioned earlier. And, growers that get those contracts will probably do quite well.
So this is talking about, for example, the cannabinoids, the CBD oil that we certainly hear a lot, especially in terms of pediatric use, medical use.
Yeah, CBD is probably the most highly recognized of the cannabinoids in the plant as far as having that medicinal value. But there are other smaller ones, too. The plant produces some 100 different compounds that fall into that cannabinoid category. So there's potential there for even more. Particularly, what pulls it into light now is with all the opioid problems, there's some potential there for pharmaceuticals too, for pain relief, those types of uses.
I'm speaking, if you've just joined us, with Kurt Thelen, who's a professor in the Department of Plant, Soil, and Microbial Sciences at Michigan State University, as we look into the prospect of industrial hemp in Michigan. Now, there has been some legislative chatter both in Lansing and nationwide on industrial hemp. Michigan's ballot initiative to legalize recreational marijuana would also legalize hemp growing. Do you worry, Kurt, that tying hemp to marijuana legalization might confuse people on the crucial difference between the two?
Well, yeah, it certainly won't help with regard to that. I also think to really address the issue, we still have to fix the problem of it being regulated at the federal level under the Schedule 1 regulation, because farmers still wouldn't be able to bring in seed from outside the state legally. Chances are they could probably find a way to get it done, but then they're always going to be potentially subject to that regulation. So I think, that it's certainly a step in the right direction, to take care of it at state level, whether it be through a referendum or through legislation at state level. But we're still, to really fix the problem, we have to address the federal regulation as well and somehow get it deregulated under Schedule 1.
And to that point, the 2018 Farm Bill, which came out of a Senate committee with a 20-1 vote of support, includes hemp legalization legislation, and it's backed by Mitch McConnell, a Senate Majority Leader. Would this be, shall we call it a cure-all?
Yes, I think that would really be the thing that really gets the ball rolling, because I see that as probably the major obstacle at this point. So once you take care of that, I think a lot of the states are going to fall in line and get their own regulations to address the issue of legalizing the industrial hemp component of it, at least.
And there is some movement, is there not, in Lansing towards changing state laws regarding hemp?
Yeah, there has been interest at that level. There's support from the major farm groups as well behind that. There's still, you know, it does present a problem, and I can understand it from a law enforcement perspective. As we alluded to earlier, you really can't tell the difference by looking at the plants. So that does raise some issues there, too, with law enforcement. And so some of those things still, some sticky-type problems there need to be kind of addressed as well.
Kurt Thelen is a Michigan State University professor in the College of Agriculture and Natural Resources with the latest on growing hemp in Michigan, industrial hemp. Kurt, thanks so much for being with us on Stateside.
No problem. Glad to talk with you.
And that's our Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.